Obama's blackout over Sudan is very disturbing. The longest war in this century is still in progress and is intensifying in the largest country in Africa, Sudan. The Muslim Arab North has been attacking the Christians in the Black South. The death toll since 1955 is estimated at 2 million. Peter Hemmen, director of Frontline Fellowship in Cape Town, has the story.
The atrocities in Sudan have been the most severe in the Nuba Mountains in central Sudan. Most of the villages and churches have been destroyed. Hundreds of Christians have been crucified, and over 1 million people have been forced into concentration camps. Christian soldiers, who are literally fighting for their lives, point out that the Christians in Sudan have a heritage of standing firm as a bulwark against the expansion of militant Islam into Central Africa for 1,400 years. The Douma Mountains lie in the center of Sudan, covering about 30,000 square miles in South Kordofan. The Rocky Mountains rise sharply, 1,500 feet to 3,000 feet above the surrounding clay plains. The land, some of it forested and some farmed, is amongst the most fertile land in Sudan. That is both a blessing and a curse to the Nuba. The Nuba are a cluster of 50 different ethnic groups, estimated to number 1,200,000 people. The Nuba possess a wide cultural diversity, all of which share a love of music and of dancing. Many of the tribes are also known for their body painting, their elaborate scarification, their wrestling and their stick fighting. Most of the Nuba are farmers, cultivating the hills in elaborate terraces or the clay plains. Over the centuries, many powerful states have raided the Nuba for slaves. The Nuba retreated to these central mountains in order to better resist external invaders. Some of the Nuba date their Christianity back to the early centuries. While the mystical Sufi sect of Islam has also spread widely amongst the Nuba, Christianity has been on the increase. Christianity has become very attractive to the Nuba youth, in particular, precisely because it is being opposed by the government of Sudan. The Muslim government of Sudan began the campaign of church burning in the Nuba in August 1985. The church at Daru was destroyed and 4 Christians were killed. The most prominent Christian village, Lubi, was burned down in July 1988. The destruction of churches has now become so commonplace that people interviewed seldom even mentioned it. When we asked if their church was burned down during any specific attack, the answer always was, of course. The leaders of the Episcopal Church in the Nuba Mountains have reported in April 1996 that the government of Sudan troops had so far burnt down 26 Episcopal churches alone during the past years. At the beginning of 1996, the churches in Tarora and Barera were also razed to the ground. 5 clergymen of the Episcopal Church had been murdered by the government of Sudan forces in just the last few years. There were still remaining 7 pastors and 72 churches in this one denomination in the SPLA-controlled areas of the Nuba Mountains. A leader of the Evangelical Church reported that his church, with 2,000 members, had no ordained pastors left in the Nuba Mountains. 2 of the catechists training for the pastorate had actually been executed by the government of Sudan recently. The church also was without a single Bible at that time. One Christian leader described the process leading up to the wholesale destruction of church buildings and the slaughter of Christians. I quote, "In 1985 we were told to register our arms so that we could be given ammunition. But it was a trick. All the ammunition was given to the Arabs, and in 1987 the government came and confiscated all the rifles they could." Unquote. From 1985, the Military Council of Sudan began to arm the Bagaras, that's literally the cattle people, Arab Muslims who live in the Nuba area. This seemed to be a charter for the Arab nomads to become more aggressive and violent towards the Nuba Christians. Sudden attacks, theft of cattle, abductions of Nubas escalated. A Muslim force called the Murhalin began to forcibly disarm the Nuba population, stealing as many cows as possible in the process. One Christian described the process. "They had modern guns, weird old guns, muskets, but we still chased them. The Arabs left, they brought the army, they armed themselves more. began to attack us, and they continued attacking us. The problems have never stopped since. In 1986, a tiny Jebel's task force entered the Nuba to recruit for the Sudanese People's Liberation Army, the SPLA. They had so far, up to that stage, only been active in the south of Sudan. But now they entered into the center of Sudan, into the Nuba Mountains. The harsh oppression of the Arab government had led many Nuba to join the SPLA. And by 1987, the first SPLA fighting battalion, made up of Nuba volunteers, the Volcano Battalion, entered the Nuba Mountains. They won several important battles, and they secured a substantial area. Nuba youth flocked to join the SPLA, and by 1989, the new Kush Division, six battalions of freshly trained new recruits, were mobilized in the Nuba. The systematic violence of the Muslim government against the Nuba forced many to turn to the SPLA for protection. After the 1989 coup d'etat, the extremist National Islamic Front government, the NIF, unleashed a ferocious scorched earth campaign. In February 1990, the government of Sudan called all the chiefs in the Nuba Mountains to assemble at Lagoa. Of the 14 chiefs who came, each one was arrested, bound, and shot by the government of Sudan. In 1992, the government of Sudan declared officially that jihad, holy war, existed against the Nuba. Iranian military advisors were flown in to assist in the training and the deployment of the Mujahideen. First, they instituted a vicious purge within the army, removing all officers who were not considered supportive. Then, they unleashed an unprecedentedly large military offensive against the Nuba. Helicopter gunships, MiG-23 fighter bombers, and Antonov aircraft began the aerial bombardment of marketplaces and villages. A massive ground assault on Jebel Talushi was repeatedly beaten back and repelled by the SPLA. And finally, the government of Sudan forces withdrew. A massive campaign of forced removals was then launched. Hundreds of thousands of Nuba people were forced at gunpoint to abandon their villages, which were burnt. And they were marched to concentration camps, which were euphemistically called peace camps. These unfortunate people suffered dreadful hardships without any adequate food or medical care over the long forced marches and in the camps in which they were finally dumped. By the middle of 1992, the SPLA and the government of Sudan had fought one another to a standstill. The SPLA had repeatedly repulsed the largest series of military offensives ever mounted by the government of Sudan. However, the massive deployment of government of Sudan forces had also halted the expansion of the SPLA and their liberated zones. The jihad was not abandoned. However, never again did the government of Sudan attempt such massive conventional military assaults. They had lost just too many soldiers, and such a vast amount of weaponry had fallen into the hands of the SPLA. For their part, the SPLA also had their own problems, mainly due to the August 1991 split in the SPLA, where much of the Upper Nile had defected to the Mashar al-Nashir, or SSIM, faction. This cut off the SPLA supply routes to the Nuba. Resupply now had to take the much longer and more hazardous route through Bahr el-Ghazal. One expedition through this waterless wasteland ended in disaster, when half of the 400 men died of thirst. During the rainy season, another such supply column lost 100 men drowned in floods. Sudan is one of the harshest terrains to travel across. In February 1993, the worst massacre occurred when the Muslims attacked El Abad. Over 1,900 civilians were massacred, 12,000 cows were stolen, and the village and crops were burnt down. From late 1993, however, the sheer scale of human suffering had exhausted everyone concerned. There were no more frontal assaults on SPLA positions, and there were fewer large massacres. The vicious ethnic cleansing of 1992 had been modified to the combing strategy of depopulating the rebel-controlled areas by scorched earth and forced removals. Draining the sea to catch the fish, as one put it. Everything necessary to sustain life was destroyed or removed. Pseudo-guerrillas were also infiltrated, and they carried out campaigns of arson, assassination, and abduction. One eyewitness of a government of Saddam attack on a village gave this account. Enemy came first at midday, shelling with heavy artillery, and then they shelled a village to roar, terrorizing the people to flee. When they reached the stream, they opened fire intensively and the grass began to catch fire. Some advanced to the marketplace. Others remained stationed behind trees or in the riverbed, so they surrounded the whole village. The tank patrolled around. They took our food. They burnt what they could not take. They slaughtered the goats, leaving them as carcasses. Another victim, Isaac, described what happened. When we heard the enemy coming, we scattered our belongings before escaping. But the enemy collected them and burnt everything. All our 4 granaries, all our 12 sacks of maize, the whole village was ablaze. We have no food left. But the neighboring communities are giving us food. We cannot, we will not move away. This is our village. We are rebuilding before the rainy season starts. We know the intention of the governor Stan. They want us to go to their peace camps. But we will not go. I will stay and rebuild my home and fight if they come again. This is the quote of Isaac. The government of Sudan is now pursuing a policy of avoiding military engagements with the SPLA guerrillas. It concentrates all its efforts on attacking defenseless villages and kidnapping or killing unarmed civilians. Under the name Combing, the government of Sudan Army is engaging in the systematic destruction of all the villages in the Nuba Mountains. Furniture, clothes and household goods are looted. Livestock is stolen. Whatever cannot be carried away is destroyed. Many people have been killed or injured in these combing operations. The government of Sudan forces kill with complete impunity. Old or disabled people who cannot run away are generally shot or burned to death with a village. Central to the government of Sudan's strategy is attracting international assistance to the garrison towns and the peace camps. Since the war began, there have been no humanitarian programs allowed in the SPLA-held areas. In contrast, since 1993, some international relief agencies have begun operating in Kadugli and other government-held towns, enticing the Nuba people to flee from the liberated zones and surrender themselves to be interned in the government concentration camps. In these so-called peace camps, an aggressive Islamization and Arabization indoctrination campaign is seeking to force the inmates to convert to Islam. Children as young as 12, though most are 15 or over, are forcibly conscripted into the Popular Defense Force, or PDF, of the government of Sudan. The peace camps are also being used as labor camps, providing a pool of slave labor for the government, communal farms, and military projects. Christians have been warned not to gather for prayer or worship. If you pray again, you will be killed, is the common threat. Those who attempt to escape have been subjected to a whole range of penalties, from confiscation of all property, including clothes, to torture and summary execution. The entire peace camp program is dominated by the objective of converting the internees to Islam and to the Arab culture. The only schools allowed are Kalwas, Quranic schools. One man who was shot in the knee and had his kneecap shattered was brought to these peace camps and refused water or medical care unless he renounced Christianity and pledged himself to become a Muslim, reciting the Islamic creed. This he refused to do. They beat his other kneecap until it was shattered by their rifle butts. He still refused to renounce his faith in Christ. They left him out in the open, refusing him both medical care and water. That night, he pulled himself on his arms, having no use of his legs anymore, managed to get through the barbed wire, and he pulled himself across the harsh, rocky ground of the Nuba Mountains into the mountainous areas and behind the lines into the SPLA areas. He saved one leg, the other leg is wooden, and on a crutch, he is now hobbling around with a rifle in the other hand, fighting for freedom. The government of Sudan's strategy is to depopulate the rural areas and provide a captive civilian population in their concentration camps. At present, there are an estimated 200,000 Nuba in SPLA's liberated area and about 1 million under the government of Sudan control in peace camps. These are concentration camps in the truest sense of the word. The rural population has been forcibly concentrated in these camps to control their movements, to provide a captive population for indoctrination, for forced acculturalization into the Arabic culture and Islamic religion, for forced labor, and for conscription into the People's Defense Force militia. A central component of the genocide against the Nuba is the government of Sudan's policy of mass rape. Every Nuba woman who has been in a peace camp has either been raped or threatened with rape. Girls as young as 9 years old have been raped, with the soldiers justifying this child abuse from the Hadith, the Islamic book on the life of Muhammad, saying that Muhammad married Aisha at 9 years old. Women have been raped as they were abducted, gang raped on arrival at garrisons, and repeatedly raped in peace camps or labor camps, or forcibly married to Muslim soldiers for the duration of their tours of duty. The aim of this sexual violence and slavery, and this policy of slavery and sexual violence, has been to destroy the social fabric of Nuba society. Another component of Government of Sudan policy is the strict blockade of SPLA areas. No trade is permitted, no relief agencies are allowed to work there. So far, the United Nations and other humanitarian agencies have failed to effectively challenge this exclusion. When ceasefires have been called in the south, the war has always carried on relentlessly in the Nuba Mountains. So far this year, frontline missionaries have managed to smuggle over 500 Arabic Bibles into the Nuba Mountains behind enemy lines. Many more are needed, along with medicines, clothing and blankets. The exceptionally severe human rights abuses and suffering and persecution of the Christian communities in the Nuba Mountains must be the very worst experienced anywhere in the world today. At this critical time, the Nuba need the prayers, the solidarity, and the practical support of Christians worldwide. It is over 120 years since General Charles Gordon suppressed the slave trade in Sudan. Before he began his campaign, 7 out of every 8 Sudanese were slaves. Incredible as it may seem, the specter of slave raiders swooping down in unprotected villages is once again becoming commonplace in Sudan. Tens of thousands of Sudanese Christian men, women, and children have been kidnapped and sold as slaves by Government of Sudan forces. The thunderous sound of horses made the villagers of Namlil drop their hoes and scatter into the bush. Gunfire crackled around the village as 300 men on horseback, camels, and on foot crashed through the fields of maize. Clad in turbans and jalabas, long white robes, they brandished AK-47 and G3 assault rifles, swords and spears. Within minutes, they had killed 82 men. The invaders were Arab slave raiders from the north. Their victims were Dinka Christians. First they seized the cattle, then they searched from hut to hut, gathering food, blankets and slaves. In one hut they grabbed Abduk Marokir, a blind Dinka woman. "Now you belong to me," she was told. During this raid, the Muslims captured 282 men, women and children, from Namlil. When 3 men tried to escape from the slave column, 2 were shot, and the third had his throat cut. Then several women were selected for gang rape. Even blind Abduk was abused by her captors. After 2 days' forced march, Abduk reached a compound where she was told that this would be her home. Soon she was carrying firewood, collecting firewood and carrying water and washing clothes as a slave for her Arab master. After 2 months of bondage, Abduk persuaded her Arab guards to give her a few moments of privacy. She then managed to meet up with her mother and sister, who took her by the hand and helped her escape into the darkness. Now they are back in Namlil, but Abduk's son and daughter are still enslaved. One Arab slave trader openly described how marauding gangs of soldiers have regularly swooped down on villages of Christians, killing, looting, and capturing as many as possible for slavery. This campaign is part of the National Islamic Front's government's campaign to Islamize the south of Sudan. The slaves, in most cases children and young women, are taken north where they are forced to provide agricultural labor, domestic work, and sexual services against their will. Slavery is being used to debilitate the Christian communities. They are forcibly being dispersed and or imprisoned. They have to surrender and submit to becoming Muslims, or they are killed. A captured Muslim PDF officer, Fajela Wadamata from Dastpur, testified, "We were armed by the government of Sudan to fight. We were asked to collect children, sheep, goats, cattle, and we used to burn some houses. Whatever was taken belonged to the PDF, and that was our income." He said that children who were captured and raped were brought up as slaves by the captors, being used to look after livestock or do domestic work. He described the significance of the railway from El Obeid to Wau. The train comes from the north to the south, taking troops and weapons to the south. When it returns with people, he said. Deng Atul Kwang from Path near Namlil recounted, "My wife and four children were abducted during a raid in March 1994. Three of the children and my wife managed to escape, but my eight-year-old daughter Abduk remained behind. She is now kept in Nayakata in southern Darfur by a man named Ahmed Ahmed, who brought her from her captor. When I discovered where she was, I went north and I tried to get her back by legal means. I opened a case against Ahmed Ahmed at the police station at Dere Dere, and I had to pay the police 20,000 Sudanese pounds to do this. A police officer named Abdullah accompanied me to the house of Ahmed. This man demanded 50,000 Sudanese pounds for her release. A policeman said that he had bought the girl and therefore she was his property. I was forced to leave her there, where she is badly mistreated by Ahmed's wife, who calls her by the Muslim name Hawa. I also lost the 20,000 Sudanese pounds which a policeman refused to return to me. I had to return home empty-handed." There is no longer any doubt that slavery is widespread in Sudan. There are also frequent and consistent reports that slaves are being exported to Muslim countries in the Persian Gulf and to Libya. Many of these captives are beaten, treated brutally, and sexually abused. Many are branded like cattle. Slaves who are caught trying to escape are often beaten, mutilated, or even murdered. Some slaves have had their tendons cut to prevent them from being able to escape again. Slavery acts as both an inducement for the PDF Muslim militias to attack the South and as a weapon of terror to destabilize the South. Even the United Nations Commission on Human Rights has acknowledged the existence of slavery in the South of Sudan. I quote from a February 1996 report to the Commission on Human Rights from the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Sudan, Dr. Gaspar Biro. He presented documentation on a systematic pattern of aerial bombardments of civilian targets, arbitrary arrests, detention without due process of law, torture, extrajudicial killings, summary executions, forced removals, forced labor, and slavery by the government of Sudan. According to his 31-page typed report, the slave trade is most prevalent in Bahr el-Ghazal and in the Nuba Mountains. I quote from this report, "Abduction of southern civilians has become a way of conducting the war. The abduction of persons, mainly women and children, belonging to racial, ethnic, and religious minorities from southern Sudan, the Nuba Mountains, and the Ingasema Hills areas, the subjection to the slave trade, including traffic in and sale of children and women, slavery, servitude, and forced labor, and similar practices, are taking place with the knowledge of the government of Sudan and with a tacit approval of the government of Sudan. We have many testimonies of courage amidst this terrible carnage and abuse of human rights." One Dinka tribesman testifies of how his 10-year-old daughter and 8-year-old son had been taken from him in Ayil in 1992 by the Muslims. After many weeks, he and his wife managed to find a slave camp where his children were being indoctrinated into Islam. He described it as a large camp with many straw buildings, each occupied by 50 to 60 children. Most of these children were from Nuba or Dinka tribes. The children were forced to attend the Islamization school and to cultivate the large Dura farms around the camp. By God's grace, he and his wife managed to locate their children, sneak out of the camp, and escape back to the village with their children. Michael was an 11-year-old boy who was rounded up with other Christians in the marketplace by the Muslim police. The boys were interned in a camp where they lived under armed guard and were subjected to severe beatings with camel whips. All the boys were from Dinka, Nuer, and Nuba tribes. They were all given Islamic names. They were not permitted to use their Christian names or ancestral family names. Michael was renamed Muhammad. They were forced to learn how to pray and to recite Quranic verses in Arabic. Failure to perform led to savage beatings. They were forced to hold a brick in each hand above their heads for a long time. After they failed escape attempts and other more severe punishment, Michael and his friends managed to escape and return to their families. The majority of Sudanese women also suffer systematic discrimination, repression, and degradation at the hands of the National Islamic Front government. Women have often been arrested and flogged, whipped, for failing to adhere to Islamic dress codes. One Christian lady reported that she was arrested and threatened with sexual abuse for not wearing an Islamic veil. "The chief officer wanted me to pay the cost of releasing me in bed," she said. "Of course I refused. In court I saw many women and the police were hitting them. I fell to the ground and fainted." Once she recovered, the judge sentenced her to be lashed. "This was carried out immediately in front of the judge. They took the shirt off my back and then lashed me. When I kept silent and was not affected, the judge said I defied him and he ordered me to be lashed in excess. These floggings are normally done with a camel whip and they leave a deep and permanent welt on the skin." Clement Deng was born into an animist Dinka family. When he was 12 years old, he left his home to serve a Muslim family. At this point, Clement was persuaded to become Muslim, and he enrolled in a Quranic school. He was troubled, however, by the way the teachers justified the killing of all Christians and other non-Muslims who refused to recite the Islamic creed. After much heart-searching, Clement became a Christian in 1977. Clement's conversion infuriated his fellow students in the Quranic school. When he was warned that he had been condemned to death, the penalty prescribed by Islamic law for apostasy, and when he was informed that his former friends were now planning to kill him, Clement fled to Wad Madinah. There he served in the local church until the war erupted in 1983. Another local Arab Muslim leader, Abdullah, was converted to Christ after he saw a vision of the Lord Jesus. He managed to persuade his entire clan to be converted to Christ, and this provoked the Muslim authorities into a rage. Amidst the ensuing persecution, Clement fled to Khartoum. While he was serving in a church in Akret, a suburb of Khartoum, Clement came to know some Christian boys who had been captured in the south and interned in an Islamic slave training camp. These boys were soon to be sold as slaves to Saudi Arabia, to Libya, and to Iranians. Clement organized an escape in which one of these slaves managed to evade capture and actually flee from Khartoum. Clement was suspected, and 3 days later, 5 masked men of the Popular Defense Force came to his home, assaulted him, and abducted him. Clement was taken to one of Khartoum's ghost houses, where he was beaten and tortured daily with electric rods. They repeatedly told him to stop teaching at the church. Clement did not expect to survive the ghost house. His friends, Emmanuel Henry, Peter Marlowe, and John Bull, had never been seen alive again after their arrest. Yet, after 7 days, Clement was dumped semi-conscious in the road outside his church, probably as a warning to others. After recovering from his injuries, Clement fled from the north, and he now serves the Lord at the Muriel Mission Station.
This is the end of Side 1. Please turn the tape over. Peter Hammond continues his African report with a positive solution for the problems of Sudan.
Only when one studies Islam can one begin to understand the government of Sudan and why the black Christians in the south are so determined to resist them. According to the National Islamic Front government in Sudan, the Quran teaches that men are superior to women, that a woman is to receive only half as much as a man in inheritance, that a woman's witness in court is only half that of a man, that women are the possessions of men, that women are unclean, and if a man even touches a woman, even his wife, he is unclean for prayer. Sora 4 verse 34 even says that women should be beaten, but they can be divorced merely by a verbal announcement. But a wife has no such rights in the Quran. Men may marry up to 4 wives at a time, and Allah will forgive a person who forces his slave girls into prostitution. All these verses are a well documented for those who are interested in the faith and the Foreign Sudan book. The Quran also teaches, according to the National Islamic Front government, that Muslims are superior to all others. Ye Muslims are the best of all peoples evolved for mankind. Muslims are also forbidden to befriend Jews or Christians. Quote, O ye who believe, take not the Jews and the Christians for your friends and protectors. They are but friends and protectors to each other. And he amongst you who turns to them for friendship is one of them. Islam instructs its adherents to fight until all their opponents submit. Christians and Jews may be spared if they pay the jizya, the penalty tax, with willing submission. Quote, fight those who believe not in God nor the last day, nor acknowledge the religion of truth, even if they are the people of the book, until they pay jizya, tribute taxes, with willing submission, and feel themselves subdued. Unquote. Another passage in the Quran, in Surah 9, it says, fight and slay the pagans wherever ye find them, and seize them, beleaguer them, and lie in wait or ambush for them in every stratagem of war. But if they repent and establish regular prayers and practice regular charity, then open the way for them. For those who resist Islam, mutilation or execution is decreed. The punishment for those who wage war against Allah and His Apostle and strive with might and main for mischief throughout the land is execution or crucifixion, or the cutting off of the hands and feet from opposite sides, or exile from the land. This from Surah 5. The Hadith, which is a record of the words and deeds of Muhammad, is also viewed by Muslims as inspired. Next to the Quran, it is the most important source of Islamic law. Its teachings are regarded as binding on all Muslims. The Hadith teaches that women are deficient in intelligence and religion, that women are an affliction harmful to men, that women are a bad omen, and the majority of the damned in hell are women. The Hadith also teaches that apostasy is punishable by death. Whoever changes his Islamic religion, kill him, it says in volume 957. A Muslim may not be punished for killing a non-Muslim. No Muslim should be killed for killing a kafir or an infidel, states the Hadith. Those who die in holy war are guaranteed to go to heaven, according to the Hadith. The person who participates in jihad, holy battles, in Allah's cause, and nothing compels him to do so, except belief in Allah and His Apostle, will be recompensed by Allah, either with a reward or booty, if he survives, or he will be admitted to paradise if he is killed. Read this in volume 135. In the light of these teachings, which are fervently held and propagated by the National Islamic Front government of Sudan, it becomes clear that the rift between the Muslim Arab North and the Christian Black South in Sudan is just too vast. Partition is the only sane answer. The Black South is suffering under colonial oppression of the Muslim North, just as Eritrea needed to be set free from Ethiopia, and Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia allowed to secede from the Soviet Union, so too the South should be allowed self-determination. Decolonialization and independence for the South is essential. On Thursday, the 11th of January, 1996, an imam of the Islamic Propagation Center International in South Africa defended polygamy, jihad, and the crucifixion of Muslims who convert to Christianity. This was during a presentation to an international group participating in a Frontline Fellowship's discipleship training course. When I mentioned that I had recently returned from Sudan, where hundreds of Christians in the Nuba Mountains had been crucified by the Islamic government there, the imam responded that the Quran prescribed the death penalty for apostasy. Therefore, he claimed that any Muslim who left the Islamic religion deserved to be crucified. In April 1989, the international community launched Operation Lifeline Sudan, or the OLS. This initiative was to prevent a recurrence of the 250,000 deaths from war and famine that Sudan had experienced the previous year. The OLS, or Operation Lifeline Sudan, is an association of the United Nations, the UN, and of non-governmental organizations or NGOs which are pledged to supply emergency assistance to civilians in need, regardless of which conflicting party controlled the area in which they live. Two of the key founder members of the OLS have been the United Nations Children's Funds, UNICEF, and the UN World Food Programme, WFP. Over 40 non-governmental organisations are now linked under OLS, which, due to a tripartite agreement between the United Nations, the Governors then, and the SPLA, only serve those areas approved by Khartoum at the time. The Nuba Mountains were excluded. OLS estimate that 7.5 million people were vulnerable to famine. 3.5 million lived in the three southern provinces of Bahr el-Ghazal, Equatoria, and Al-Panal. Of these, 700,000 were considered to be at the greatest risk, living on the very edge of survival. Another 1.3 million people of the south had fled to the so-called transitional zone between north and south. There were an estimated 700,000 displaced southerners living in squatter camps just outside Khartoum, the capital. The infant mortality rates in Sudan were calculated as 102 per thousand, and for under 5-year-olds, 169 per thousand. Malaria, diarrhea, and acute respiratory infections are commonplace, and malnutrition rates as high as 80% amongst children under 5. And these have been reported in some locations. The OLS reports that they are moving 140 metric tons of food and non-food cargo every day from Logotchokio in northern Kenya into southern Sudan. More than 10 aircraft are making about 50 takeoffs and landings each day. However, despite impressive statistics, we have repeatedly heard some serious accusations against the United Nations from people on the ground in southern Sudan. Several NGOs and pilots have said this is a racket. Most of these aid workers don't care about the people in Sudan. One British NGO claimed, Lockie is packed full of time servers getting fat on 5-course meals a day, with 15 food choices 3 times a day. Several people commented on their shock at the extravagance, gluttony, and wastage evidenced at the OLS dining hall in Logotchokio. As one American relief worker commented, this OLS compound in Lockie is surreal. There they are, within a few miles of serious famine, claiming to be there to feed the starving, while gorging themselves on large quantities of luxury foods and desserts. Other accusations were far more serious. The OLS is full of blood-sucking parasites, squandering resources and enriching themselves while pretending to aid the starving. This English aid worker described the extravagant salaries, the excessive living expenses allowances, and the fabulous fringe benefits as the main reason why most of the relief workers were at Lockie. He also gave several shocking examples of wastage and corruption. Now, while it would be unfair to level these accusations at all aid workers, there must be many sincere and even some sacrificial workers, the incidents of wastage, corruption, and callous indifference abound. The district commissioner in Namlil complained that for most of the time since the government of Sudan launched an offensive against Namlil in March 1995, the area had been designated a no-go area by the United Nations. During this attack, 82 civilians were murdered and 282 men, women and children were captured and enslaved. Yet the wounded survivors were denied any humanitarian aid at the time when it was actually needed most. When finally, a year later, Namlil was removed from the no-go list, hopes were raised that some medicines or food would at last be supplied. The people were stunned when the United Nations sent an empty Buffalo transport plane with a 7-ton carrying capacity in order to take away a pickup truck. Another aircraft came to take away a tractor. Another Buffalo flew in with 7 tons of sand and stone for a water sanitation project. However, in Namlil, sand and stones were plentiful. The local people were bitterly disillusioned with the aid organizations and bitterly disappointed that the reopening of the airstrip seemed to have resulted in an overall loss of already scarce resources. Many Sudanese Christians complained to us about the United Nations ban and bias against Christians. Their ban on Bibles being transported into Sudan was the most offensive, but they also mentioned many occasions when church-related relief flights were cancelled. As Christians, we are lower than third-class citizens in the eyes of the United Nations, said one. Christian organizations such as the New Sudan Council of Churches and Across had even been banned by the United Nations for having any relief flights for a month, simply for attempting to take Bibles into Sudan. Several of our own frontline fellowship missionaries, like myself, have had numerous flights arbitrarily cancelled by the United Nations. Amish Mies have also actually been threatened by United Nations officials that any non-United Nations authorized flights would be shot down by Government of Sudan helicopter gunships and jet fighters stationed in Juba. It is also a shocking fact that the Nuba Mountains, which have been the site of the worst atrocities and home to the most desperately needy people in Sudan, have been completely excluded from the OLS relief program. Officers in the SPLA also had their own critical observations. I quote, "Under the guise of feeding the starving and suffering Sudanese civilians, the OLS, or UN, is actually sustaining the Muslim garrison towns. As another put it, there is a great imbalance. Many more OLS planes and bigger aircraft fly to the Muslim garrison towns each day than to SPLA-held towns. This is how they are maintaining 100,000 Arab troops in the south. The United Nations is feeding them." He also pointed out that the reported flight schedules were deceptive, as flights to the Christian towns were routinely cancelled. A civilian observer put it even more bluntly. I quote, "The United Nations is providing the government of Sudan with an efficient air force. The OLS is effectively serving as the logistical support arm of the government of Sudan troops in the south. In this way, they are actually prolonging the war." Several pastors and non-governmental organizations confirmed that the government of Sudan troops in Juba and Wau, for example, had complete control of all the relief aid being flown in by the United Nations. They maintained that refugees fleeing from these towns report mass starvation, while the government of Sudan troops requisitioned the relief aid. Those civilians who wanted any part of the food aid were forced to convert to Islam. We received multiple testimonies of the abuse of relief aid in Muslim-controlled areas. Food aid has routinely been abused as a weapon for enforced Islamization and Arabization. Not only are recipients forced to beg for food in the name of Allah and to recite the Islamic creed, but they are forced to change their Christian names to Arabic names. Those nations and organizations which are funding aspects of Operation Lifeline Sudan of the United Nations should institute a thorough investigation into these accusations of corruption, wastage, of the anti-Christian bias, the mismanagement of resources, and of the abuse of relief aid by the government of Sudan forces. In Africa's largest country, Sudan, the oldest community of Christians in Africa is suffering the most severe persecution. Yet, amidst the longest war of this century, some of the most resilient and revived churches have flourished. When I recently returned from a 15,000-kilometer trip to and across war-torn southern Sudan, by God's grace, our mission team had managed to smuggle into this officially Muslim country more than 3,000 Bibles and hundreds of Christian books in five different languages. On one of these trips, we took part in a church conference just 20 kilometers from the battlefront. The conference site was specially constructed in the forest and carefully camouflaged under tree cover in the event of an air raid. The last such church gathering had been subjected to aerial bombardment, and our hosts didn't want to take unnecessary chances. Most of our time was taken up with the leadership training courses. The local church leaders and school teachers were very enthusiastic and responsive. Most nights we were kept up late answering problems and theological and ethical questions from sometimes 100 or more people around the campfires. Amidst bullet-scarred walls and roofs torn by exploded bombs, we personally presented Bibles to the governor of Equatoria, the military commander of Western Equatoria, the chief of staff, the chief justice, and to the district commissioners of Maridi and Mundri. Permission was granted to us to serve as Christian chaplains to the Sudanese People's Liberation Army. And we were granted permission to minister throughout the rebel-controlled areas. The SPLA resistance reported controlling now over 90% of the south of Sudan. The Muslim government of Sudan now only controls a few besieged garrison towns in the south, and this at great cost. Christians in southern Sudan reported an intensification of daily bombing raids by the Sudanese Air Force, but they also reported a slackening off of ground assaults. They detailed the intense suffering caused by the scorched earth policies of the government of Sudan, the enslavement of many of their young people, the forcible circumcision of men in Muslim-controlled areas, the homosexual molestation of boys by Muslim masters, and the abuse of relief aid to force conversions to Islam. They told us how aid in government-controlled areas is routinely denied to Christians and only given to those who convert to Islam. One of our co-workers, George, had to dive into a rubbish pit as Sudanese Air Force bombing raid laid a string of bombs across the town, which he was conducting a leadership training course. One bomb landed within the African Land Church compound where the course was being held, just a few meters from where George was taking cover. When we asked the Sudanese Christians what their greatest needs are, one Christian detailed the following: Bibles in our mother tongues, leadership training for spiritual workers, medicine, tools for agriculture, peace, freedom, and friends to put pressure on the Muslim government of Sudan. Another pastor exclaimed, "At times like this, we learn who our true friends are. Only good friends would visit us during such dangerous times." At one chaplaincy service, I presented a gospel message to more than 1,500 men of all ranks. These soldiers responded so enthusiastically that I had some trouble maintaining the flow of the message, as they often interrupted with applause and cheers. Afterwards, they poured forwards in order to receive Bibles, but we soon ran out, and we had to send most away empty-handed with the promise that we would return with more soon, which we did. We also managed to distribute Bibles to each of the war-wounded patients at the Red Cross Hospital in Logochogia. At this hospital, the only functioning medical facility for the South Sudanese, patients come from every corner of the war-devastated land. I was mobbed by a virtual stampede of patients, many on only one leg or with only one arm, desperately pleading for their own copy of the Word of God in their own language. Afterwards, silence descended upon the hospital tents as hundreds of patients sat reading their own copy of the Bible, many for the very first time. Tears were running down some cheeks. Some patients were gathered around one person who would read the Bible out aloud for maybe those who were not literate and needed someone else to read it for them. The intense reverential awe of all these people in the presence of the Word of God in their own language for the first time was overpowering. The opportunities for ministry in southern Sudan are so great. The suffering is so intense. The needs are so desperate. The largest country in Africa, in the grip of the longest war of the century, requires our greatest missionary efforts. The oldest community of Christians in Africa, suffering the most severe persecution in the world, demands our most urgent and wholehearted assistance. We need your help to rise to this challenge. Please join with us in fervent prayer that the sufferings of our Christian brethren in southern Sudan become known to the whole world. Pray that the persecutors may be exposed and opposed. Pray that peace with justice be firmly established. Help us make known the plights of southern Sudan. Ensure that Sudan is remembered regularly in prayer at your church. Pray for the necessary resources to finance more Bibles, medicines, flights, and field trips to meet the desperate spiritual and practical needs in Sudan. Pray also that the Lord will lead more of the right kind of missionary volunteers to dedicate themselves to literature distribution, chaplaincy services, providing emergency medical services, and leadership training courses in Sudan. This is desperately needed. One denomination grew from two congregations to over 140 congregations in just 10 years. One pastor can have up to 70 congregations to care for. One pastor left his home one day and was gone for 15 months as he went to visit all the different congregations in his parish. He was away for 15 months, visiting approximately 1 week with each congregation before his family saw him again. When he returned, having not seen his family for 15 months, he reported that he had baptized 9,000 new Christians just in the previous 15 months. So great is the church growth in southern Sudan today. It is our deep concern to see the Christian publications of the West publicizing the plight of our beleaguered brethren and mobilizing the prayer, the pressure, and the support that is so desperately needed. Help us to make known the plight of southern Sudan. Write letters to your local newspapers. Write to your elected representatives. Urge that diplomatic and economic pressure be brought to bear upon the government of Sudan to stop their atrocities and the anti-Christian jihad. Encourage your local radio stations to report on the incredible testimonies of suffering and of Christian courage in Sudan. Ensure that Sudan is regularly remembered in prayer at the prayer meetings of your church and even at your own dinner table. Obtain a copy of Faith Under Fire in Sudan. This is a book that presents the full details of the Sudanese church, its Christian heritage, its sufferings, its courage, and of what we can practically do to help them. Copy this tape. Order the Frontline Fellowship news reports, which will keep you updated as to what is going on in Sudan, or the posters of praying for Sudan, which you can put up then in public places in your church to remind Christians to keep the brethren of Sudan before us regularly. Photocopy excerpts from the Frontline news reports. Post them to your local Christian editors. Write letters to the press urging more coverage on the untold stories of Christian courage amidst severe persecution. When speaking up for Christians in Sudan, I've often received these kind of reactions. Why are the Christians fighting back against the Muslims, I'm asked. Surely they should just turn the other cheek. Why don't the Christians just pray, some ask. They can't win Muslims to Christ by war, they must win them over by love. Well, the simple answers to these concerns are that the Christians in Sudan are praying. They pray long, hard, and deep. Their prayer meetings make ours seem juvenile. There's nothing quite like facing violent death and sudden bombardments or man-made famine to deepen anyone's prayer life. Their evangelistic zeal should also be obvious. More Muslims are coming to Christ in Sudan than anywhere else in the world today. 20 years ago, the Christians actually made up less than 5% of the total population of Sudan. Today, Christians comprise over 20% of the population of Sudan and 80% of the population of southern Sudan. Perhaps if our food supplies had been pillaged and destroyed, perhaps if our churches had been razed to the ground or our relatives crucified and our sons captured by slave raiders, then we would be fighting to protect our wives and our children as well. The words of Nehemiah 4 verse 14 are quoted often by brethren in Sudan. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. The opportunities for ministry in southern Sudan are so great, the suffering so intense. The largest country in Africa, in the grip of the longest war of the century, requires our greatest missionary efforts. The oldest community of Christians in Africa, who date the Christianity back to Acts chapter 8 in the Ethiopian eunuch, they are suffering the most severe persecution in the world today. This demands our most urgent and wholehearted assistance. We praise God that the scripture says in Psalm 72 that He will defend the afflicted among the people and save the children of the needy. He will crush the oppressor. He will endure as long as the sun, as long as the moon, through all generations. He will be like rain falling on a mown field, like showers watering the earth. In His days, the righteous will flourish. Prosperity will abound till the moon is no more. He will rule from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. The desert tribes will bow before Him, and His enemies will lick the dust. The kings of Tarshish and of distant shores will bring tribute to Him. The kings of Seba and Sheba will present Him gifts. All kings will bow down to Him, and all nations will serve Him. For He will deliver the needy who cry out, the afflicted who have no one to help. He will take pity on the weak and the needy, and He will save the needy from death. He will rescue them from oppression and violence, for precious is their blood in His sight.
From beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, my worshippers, the daughters of my dispersed ones, shall bring my offering. This was a promise of God in Zephaniah 3:10. It's to the people of the Sudan. And the psalmist, writing in Psalm 68, verse 31, assures us, Cush will submit herself to God. The largest country in Africa, in the grip of the longest war in this century, requires our greatest missionary effort. These challenging words from South African missionary Peter Hammond should catapult us into action. Each one of us has a part to play, whether large or small.
For more information and documented sources, be sure to read Face Under Fire in Sudan by Peter Hammond. You may order Faith Under Fire from Frontline Fellowship, P.O. Box 74, Newlands 7725, South Africa. In South Africa, the telephone number is area code 021-689-4480 or fax city code 021-685-5884. In the United States, you may order from In Touch Mission International, P.O. Box 28240, Tempe, Arizona 85285, or telephone area code 602-968-4100, or fax area code 602-968-5462.